NPR stations, and from Robin and Murray Sinclair, helping sustain NPR's coverage of the global economy.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. By and large, nursing homes are viewed as a last resort. But when such care is necessary, needed, how do we find good care? And how do we make certain that a loved one has the best quality of life possible after moving in? Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Joshua Shore. Dr. Shore is the medical director at Daughters of Israel, a nursing home in New Jersey. He's also the author of The Nursing Home Guide, A Doctor Reveals What You Need to Know About Long-Term Care. The book includes such information as determining whether long-term care is needed, choosing a facility, how to communicate with staff, and ask questions about medications, meals, and activities. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls this afternoon. You can join us with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana is, in the Champaign-Urbana area, is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Joshua Shore is a medical doctor who graduated from Yale University School of Medicine. He completed his residency in internal medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital and a 3-year fellowship in geriatric medicine at the Harvard University Division on Aging. His book, The Nursing Home Guide, A Doctor Reveals What You Need to Know About Long-Term Care, is available in paperback from Berkeley Books. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. And toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Shore, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. What led you to geriatric medicine?
I think it was partly personal and partly professional. I grew up in a family where we had two grandmothers who were very close and lived with us off and on and spent a lot of time with them and just got kind of used to talking to older people, felt very comfortable around them. And then when I eventually got to medical school, I was lucky enough to have a wonderful mentor back in the early 80s when geriatrics wasn't that popular and there were very few departments or divisions. But there was a Dr. Leo Cooney, who's still there at Yale and was just a terrific role model, invited us on rounds with him, taught us a lot about how to talk to and how to listen to older people.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate to have mentors along the way.
Yeah, yeah. Where is the field today?
That's a great question. I think it depends how you look at it. You know, one of the first, I think the original mission of the geriatric sort of academic departments was to not necessarily flood the market, as it were, with geriatricians, because they didn't think that would be achievable, but to train a cadre of physicians who were very skilled in geriatrics to go out and then train primary care physicians in that. And I think to some extent that's worked. I mean, I think there is a much, much greater awareness now than there was 20, 30 years ago that older people are a little bit different or a lot different. Mm. Medications are different. Reactions are different. There are a lot of syndromes in the older adult that sort of fell between the cracks before. I think, though, to everyone's disappointment, we still cannot fill the slots available to us for training younger physicians in the field, which is kind of mystifying in terms of a market sort of analysis. On the other hand, you know, that's the way it is.
Yeah. I'm very pleased that in this book you devote a good deal of attention to mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Are there specialists now in geriatric psychiatry, psychology, social work?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. In some sense, it was the tail wagging the dog, because the original people in the field were by and large, geropsychiatrist Dr. Butler, who was the head of the first department of geriatrics in the country at Mount Sinai, was actually himself a psychiatrist, and I think realized and helped others to realize that this division between the body and the mind was really an artificial one, and as one ages, it's even more artificial. There are very good geropsychiatrists doing all kinds of work, doing very good academic research work, and also out in the field. There are many in my area geriatric psychiatrists. There are also a lot of general psychiatrists who take a special interest in the elderly and are more aware of medications and side effects and things like that. Mm. So that's sort of a good story to report, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well, what are the challenges in geriatrics today?
I think, you know, on that theme of mental health care, we're seeing in nursing homes now a real change over the last 5 to 10 years, whereas for years before that, the average age in nursing homes was sort of advancing every year. Part of that was due to assisted living facilities taking away the younger sort of population. Younger, I mean, in early 80s, who were, you know, frail but able to kind of get on with a minimal amount of help. So most of those people ended up in assisted living, and we were left in nursing homes taking the oldest old, the very, very frail. What we've seen in the last 5 or 10 years is a change in the sense that we're getting more and more younger people who have mental health challenges. Some of them as young as 50s and 60s who've had either substance abuse problems or, you know, frank psychotic issues like schizophrenia, who really don't necessarily belong in a state hospital, but yet are not quite independent enough to live on their own or in a group setting in the community. So a number of those have fallen into the nursing home. And I think it's an enormous challenge because they don't, you know, they represent a different kind of care. And a whole different approach by the staff. I mean, staff in nursing homes are usually geared towards the 85, 95-year-old, you know, grandmother type. And that's not what we're seeing with this recent influx.
Mm. What problems does that pose?
Well, I think a lot of it is social sort of problems. You know, when one goes to a nursing home, you want someone in that home to feel like they're at home and that they have like-minded people to speak with. So I think it works both ways. I think having younger patients who have a very different outlook, grew up in a different generation, have different tastes in music even, mixing with a 90-year-old who might want to hear Glenn Miller or you know, Lawrence Welk. It's interesting to see that dynamic. So the more progressive homes that have enough younger people will try to what we call cohort or group them together so that they can share their own experiences. If they'd like to be on the internet more, we, you know, try to you know, have that available to them. I think also from the point of view of the physicians, it's a real change because they have to be very well-versed in psychiatric medications or when they're really not doing the trick and how to get people off of psychiatric medications. And that's true in the elderly as well. I think you're also seeing more and more people with Alzheimer's disease who are suffering from some kind of psychiatric element or part of their Alzheimer's, whether that's delusion or aggressiveness or depression, that really changes the way we think of it, not just as a pure medical illness, you know, or an organic illness, but clearly as something with mental health implications.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Joshua Shore. He's an MD, and he's the author of The Nursing Home Guide, A Doctor Reveals What You Need to Know About Long-Term Care. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Dr. Short. My 75-year-old mother, who has a type of dementia that's not Alzheimer's, for the past 5 years, is pretty stable in the home, in her home, with care. And this is more of a policy question. We're finding with this economic crisis and her money has disappeared that we can no longer afford to pay for her care in the home with Medicaid, that Medicaid wants you in the state of Illinois to put them in a home, you know, to sell the house and put them in the home, and only the state of Vermont actually pays for maintaining the person in the home. And how is it that only one state has this if the person is stable they can stay there, but, you know, none of the other states do this. And, I, you know, we've looked, you know, our family has looked at nursing homes, and it's some of it's pretty dismal, some of it okay. But, you know, if somebody can stay in the home, why not? Why does, you know, Medicaid pay for nursing home but not care in the home? Do you know anything about this?
Excellent question. The Vermont experiment is a very interesting one where they will actually pay, I believe it's family members, to care for their people at home out of Medicaid funds, which seems very progressive to me. And, you know, given the financial crisis now, certainly helps people, you know, find jobs that are fulfilling and meaningful and keep people out of nursing homes. Because as much as I champion, you know, nursing homes and the right, I mean, I certainly understand that if one can be at home in more familiar surroundings, it's certainly preferable. There are some other things. I think in Oregon they have a foster family or like a group home type experiment that's been going on for years. So that is one other alternative. There are a lot of states that will fund certain Medicaid slots for assisted livings. I don't know if Illinois fits into that. Were you able to look into that?
They do, but you have, they do.
But it still would involve leaving the home.
It involves leaving the home, and of course, you know, a lot of people don't want to leave the home,
right?
And I just don't get it, because we looked into how much it costs. It costs actually the same amount,
right,
to keep somebody in their home. Versus,
you're absolutely, I mean, make complete sense, and it's a policy issue. You might want to check if there's a local division on aging. Have you checked with them?
Most, no.
You know, most counties have one by law now, and it's usually this is a division on aging for your county. And they might know of any either. Sometimes there's some waiver programs or experiments going on with state grant funding that would help someone stay at home. So I certainly would encourage you to do that.
Division on aging.
There's also the Nursing Home Reform Group. I think it's, I forget the acronym for the group, but if you go online, look for Nursing Home Reform. Sometimes they might be a good resource. There are also day centers that the nursing home that I work at has a day center in New Jersey, and some of those slots are actually funded through Medicaid as well. Again, I don't know whether that applies to your state.
Yeah, it's just the problem is going to exacerbate as the boomers, you know, move into that age group and dementia.
Yeah,
you know, what's the percentage on people they're predicting to get dementia, something like 20% of the baby boomers, I read once.
Yeah, well, the number, you know, it's funny. The numbers are sort of vary. There was a paper that came out in the late 80s, early 90s, that actually predicted, I mean, very depressingly, that once you're over 85, I think you have a 50% chance of developing Alzheimer's. Some of the methodology of that paper has been criticized, but clearly, you know, between Alzheimer's and the other forms of dementia, you're talking about numbers that sort of that probably do approach that for the over 85 set, and with the baby boomers, you know, just hitting 65 now, it certainly is going to be an enormous policy issue, and it will probably force the state to figure it out.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Also, I would recommend the Illinois Department on Aging website, and then also there are area agencies. In our area, it's the East Central Illinois Agency on Aging, and they, I think, both have an ombudsman program.
Right.
And I'll tell you from my experience, I worked with an ombudsman, and she was heaven sent.
Yeah. Yeah, the ombudsman, you know, it's funny, nursing homes saw it as a real threat for, you know, sort of obvious reasons years ago. But I have to tell you that every time I've interacted with them, it's been a positive interaction. And in New Jersey, we're blessed to have very good ombudsmen who are very active in sort of all kinds of state issues. And they do show up at different meetings and conferences. And, you know, they take the questions, they take some of the tougher questions. And I agree with you. I think it was a wonderful reform that the country underwent.
Yeah, and I had concerns about the nursing home that my mom was in. It was more, what are my options? What should I do? Where can I go for information? Very helpful.
Right. She knew
it inside and out.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think, unfortunately, some of the less progressive nursing homes see it On the other side, where a family may say, well, I'm going to call the state, you know, if they're not satisfied, they can't sort of work things out in the nursing home. And so the state sort of becomes equal to the ombudsman's office. But we use them actually in situations where we feel that maybe a family isn't understanding, or we've tried different family meetings, we've tried different solutions, we've really been creative, and we're still at an impasse. We sometimes ourselves will call the ombudsman to say, look, do you have any other ideas? And I think if more nursing homes did that, it would probably help everyone understand how positive the ombudsman's role can be.
Mm-hmm. You note in the book, The Nursing Home Guide, that with options like home care, daycare, and assisted living, people are not likely to need the care available in nursing homes until there's a crisis. And at the same time, the length of stay in hospitals has been shortened significantly. That's good and bad. But what does that mean in terms of the demands placed on nursing homes today?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. The whole movement changed like in the early 80s. There was a government think tank that created something called the diagnosis-related groups. Basically what that means is that people had to be discharged, what we call sicker and quicker and sicker from the hospitals. So instead of staying at the hospital for 3 or 4 weeks after a heart attack or a hip fracture to get rehabilitation, to get back on their feet there, they were discharged within 3 or 4 days. And that meant that there had to be some way station for them on the way home. So most nursing homes developed something called subacute care, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners have either heard about or been faced with a decision to make about it. But that's sort of a 2 or 3 week period in which someone can receive rehabilitation at a home, mostly to get back on their feet, either a physical therapist to help with their walking or what we call an occupational therapist to help with their arms or doing things or, you know, helping to, make meals and things like that for themselves. So that is how the nursing home has sort of had to recreate itself. And in a sense, it's allowed them to be financially a little bit more stable because Medicare will pay them more to take care of someone like that because it takes more resources to do it. So nursing homes have changed a lot. Now, the negative of that is that many nursing homes have focused so much on that that they've almost become mini hospitals. And so when you walk into a home like that, it has a little bit more of a sterile feel of a hospital. They're plagued with the same infections now, these resistant bacteria that a lot of the hospitals are troubled by. You will hear doctors being paged all the time, which is certainly really disruptive to the life of the nursing home. So it cuts both ways. I mean, I think it's brought up the level of care in a lot of nursing homes in terms of the nursing expertise and the physician sort of involvement. But it's really changed the culture of the home. And a lot of my book is about the culture of the home and what you can do to keep the home in nursing home. So I appreciate the question.
Yeah. Well, let's look at a scenario I suspect is fairly common. There's a medical emergency. There's a hospitalization. Then the hospital is saying, okay, your loved one will be discharged within 2 days.
Right.
What if you're not able to have an appropriate plan together within that time frame?
Right. Well, the power sort of, believe it or not, often will lie with the family. That means that if they're saying 2 days, you can often stretch that to 3 or 4 days. And that sometimes is all you need to go visit a couple of homes. But essentially what you want to do is ask the person at the hospital as one source of information, well, what do you recommend? Now, some of them will not really officially be able to recommend one place over another. And I think I'll back up a little bit, make sure that they really need to go to a nursing home for rehabilitation. Sometimes there are people who might be able to make it at home with just a little extra help for a few days. But if it's really pretty clear from the team there, the therapist and the physician, that the loved one needs to be in a subacute facility temporarily, then I think you should ask for the list of the places nearby. Then you have to make a decision. Is geography the most important factor? In other words, if it's an older spouse who really needs to take a bus to get somewhere or has a very short radius in which they can drive, they may just want the closest place. I would encourage them to really make a visit to the home with as many family members as you can and try to go in the morning. The morning is sort of the time when the nursing home should be a beehive of activity. There should be therapy going on. There should be different discussion groups. There should just be an energy about the place. And I would also encourage, besides the person who gives the tour, to interact a little bit with the nurses on the unit, some of the nurses' aides, even some of the custodians to see what they're like. Are they interacting with the residents of the home? You know, it's really a village. Everyone should take their part in taking care of the people who live in that home. And I think a tour is very, very important. And usually you can eke out a day or two to make that visit.
Yeah. And is it reasonable to ask to come back for a second look at a later date when you don't need the official tour guide?
Yeah, what I would encourage people to do is just come back even later that day and sit in the lobby with a newspaper and sort of pretend to be reading it. I mean, it sounds a little deceptive, but I think there's no other way to get a sense of the culture of that home. And you really want to see that people who work there take a genuine interest, you know, lean over when they're talking to someone, don't talk above the residents. And I think you may be limited into how much you can walk around the home, but there's a surprising amount you can find out in the lobby, because all lobbies are really shared with the residents of the home, or they should be. If you go to a home where there's not a single resident out in the lobby, I think that would really raise some concerns. There are also resources on the Internet, which I'm not sure if you want me to get into, but that's another thing that's sort of tough.
Yeah, that would be good. In fact, I've made a note of it somewhere here, one of the places.
It's a little controversial, but about, you know, it's really since the Internet has been around, there have been ways to search your area for different nursing homes and see how they're rated. These were mostly at a cost. You'd have to pay $15 or $20 to do it. You'd submit your zip code and, you know, say how many homes you wanted to see. And they would give you the data on the homes, and then they'd rate them. Now the government will actually do it for you for free. About 3 or 4 months ago, Medicare, or CMS as it's known, announced the so-called star ratings, where they will rate or rank nursing homes on a 1 to 5 star basis, just like a hotel. It's been somewhat controversial because they identified different factors that contribute to that star rating, and they've picked 3 or 4 factors that might not be that representative. It goes back and forth, but I think they tend to correspond pretty well with the quality of the home. Some of the drawbacks to it is that if a home accepts people who are sick, let's say a home really feels they have a mission, taking care of people with tough wounds that don't heal elsewhere, well, they're going to sort of get dinged on that on the Medicare side, because they have a higher prevalence of people with wounds, and it doesn't easily sort out whether they came to the facility with wounds or the wounds arrived at the facility. So that's one issue. But you can kind of control for that by talking to people in the know, people who might be at the hospital, physician, other family members who maybe have had to avail themselves of the use of the subacute facilities.
Hmm. Also, while you're visiting, if you bump into folks who are there visiting loved ones,
absolutely,
talk with them. Also, I would recommend for Illinois residents, the Illinois Department of Public Health has some useful resources on the website there in terms of, they survey facilities and,
right.
Yeah,
I would say if it's for long-term care, I mean, the subacute is sort of usually a shorter stay, although some of those people end up staying long-term. But if it really is for long-term care, I would really encourage, beyond the official tour, to make an appointment to speak with the director of nursing. The medical director may be a little bit hard to connect with, but that might be worth it. But the director of nursing or the director of social work are the people who really kind of determine the culture of the home, along with the administrators. And, depending on your viewpoint, to some people it may be important how aggressive they are in terms of requiring someone to be, let's say, on an artificial feeding tube towards the end of life. Mm. Usually a more progressive stance would be to honor someone's living will or their advanced directives and be very involved with the hospice movement, let's say, at the home, where they're comfortable with people, going by their own wishes. There are, unfortunately, still homes that are not comfortable with that, and I think it behooves the family member or the resident themselves to ferret that out.
Okay, so questions about end-of-life care are important.
Yeah.
What do we want to hear specifically?
Well, again, that depends on your point of view. If you're someone who is a right-to-lifer and believes life at all costs, then you want to hear that they have a very aggressive policy, and unless there's something standing in their way of an official document, they really will encourage people to be on a feeding tube. I think most homes now are leaning the other way, I should hope, and I'd lean the other way, and haven't been in the field for 20 years, which is that, there does come a time, unfortunately, for the end. And hospice is very, very involved with a lot of nursing homes right now, providing for people to, you know, have a dignified death and to avoid, you know, feeding tubes. But again, that depends on the individual.
Hmm. Dr. Joshua Shore is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a medical doctor, and he is the author of The Nursing Home Guide, A Doctor Reveals What You Need to Know About Long-Term Care. The book is available in paperback from Berkeley Books. Our guest, Dr. Shore, is the medical director at Daughters of Israel, a nursing home in New Jersey. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. Well, besides the director of nursing, is there another staff member that's critical to overall quality of life within a nursing home?
Yeah, I think the administrators. Every home is supposed to have a licensed nursing home administrator, LNHA. Sometimes they come up through the ranks on the clinical side, having been a director of nursing or director of social work. Other times they're just, you know, very involved with nursing home from a pure administrative point of view. I think what you want to see from them is that they're somewhat flexible people, that they may share your philosophy of taking care of someone. You might want to ask them about restraint use. You know, restraints are an interesting story. In the 80s and 90s, there was a woman named Carter Williams who, as a social worker, really kind of took up the charge and got the country to the point, with many hearings in Washington, it was a big sensation when she went about it, to the point where very, very few nursing homes even stock restraints. And by restraints, I mean these sort of devices that either keep someone in bed when they really are struggling to get out of bed or will tie someone with a belt to a wheelchair, these things that we really just cringe when we hear them. And luckily, and to her credit and the credit of the whole nursing home industry, there are very, very few restraints that are used in nursing homes in general. And alternatively, if you went to a hospital, you would actually find them in great numbers. Now, there are different issues in the hospital, and there's sometimes it's someone on an intravenous or on some kind of medical device where their inclination is to remove themselves from that device. It's essential to their getting better. They often will get restrained. But there are a lot of other people who are simply there because they're old and may have a minor infection and do not need to be restrained, but it becomes sort of the culture of the hospital. So this is a case, and there are other examples of that, where the nursing home, I think, is out in front, or the nursing home industry is out in front, and really were the pioneers in that. I think also with avoiding the bed sores, nursing homes have been much more aggressive on that level.
And where does the industry stand today in terms of getting people out of bed and keeping them active?
Excellent question. In our nursing home, I'll just give you an example, we have to, part of the government, what the government does in doing their surveys of different nursing homes is that we have to self-report on various things. And one of the things we self-report on is how many people actually do not get out of bed every day. So I'll give you an example. In our facility of 300, we actually have two people only who we cannot get out of bed every day. And because of the rights of those people, I mean, if they were at home with someone taking care of them, they would have the right not to get out of bed. So if it really were clear that that's what they want, you know, we have to honor that. But with cajoling and coaxing and with enough sort of interesting therapy sessions or, you know, discussion groups that will make them want to get out of bed, or if the food is good enough to make them want to get out of bed and eat it, they should mostly get out of bed. And that's very, very different from hospitals. Again, not to you know, disparage hospitals, but I do make hospital rounds, and I will have a patient who from the nursing home who has gotten out every day, you know, for years at the nursing home. And when they go to the hospital, one recently told me that in 7 days she never was helped out of her bed once. And she had actually asked the staff several times to do that. Mm-hmm. And that means that they're, you know, Celeste, they're eating in bed, which is a terrible thing to do in terms of promoting pneumonia and general hygiene and stuff. So it's another reason to try to take care of people in the homes. And there are some innovative ideas on how to do that. I don't know if you want me to.
Well, we've got a listener calling in on
okay.
a cell phone, so let's take that call, and then we'll come back to this.
Okay.
Line one, cell phone. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
My experience with nursing homes, I have a factor that can be used, I think, successfully to judge homes, and that I would call the smile factor. as I walk in the lobbies and up and down the halls, some of them, everyone has a frown on their face or no expression. Other places, all of the staff, many of the staff, are joking with the residents, interacting with them, smiling, et cetera. And it seemed to me it made a huge difference in the quality of life for the residents. I'll hang up and listen to your comment.
Okay, great question. Great comment.
I'm smiling listening to that. It's really, I feel like you read my book. I mean, that is absolutely one of the key things. And that's why I think sitting in the lobby is very helpful. You really want to look at all facets. And, you know, a lot of times when you think about who's actually interacting with the residents, the doctors are barely there. The nurses are there, but they're so busy, you know, pushing their medications that they're not always there by the bedside. But the nurses' aides and a lot of times the kitchen guys are the ones who are serving the meal. And the meal is really a social time where people can feel like they're part of a family, you know, because the last thing someone wants to be is isolated in a nursing home, which unfortunately does happen. But the smile test, I like that, is really a good way to look at it. We also do a lot of cross-training. So we will have custodians who are trained sometimes in some of the certified nursing aid tasks and vice versa. And that helps everyone feel like, you know, the worst thing is to have someone say, well, that's not my job. I mean, that's a very frustrating thing that families often hear in healthcare, you know, not just nursing homes. But we have a special unit of about 50 residents who have various stages of Alzheimer's, usually in the mild to moderate side. And part of the beauty of that unit is that there's a lot going on. So people aren't left to sort of become agitated with nothing to do. There's always sort of a direction for them to be moving during the day. There's really an agenda for them. And part of that involves that the custodians on that unit actually participate with them in singing groups. And some of them have wonderful voices, and they do the karaoke with them and other things. We have one guy who's actually a mandolin player. We didn't even realize it. He plays with the mandolin orchestra, which is interesting. I've been to some of his concerts. They're really fascinating. But he is terrific, and when he can, he joins in, you know, accompanying the singing group. So I'm not trying to paint a too rosy a picture, because there's certainly, you know, there's some really difficult and sad stuff that does go on. But I think the opportunities are out there.
Okay. And before we took that call from our listener, you were talking about opportunities for getting people out of bed.
Right. Not just to get people out of bed, but to avoid them going to the hospital. Too often, I think the reflex, and this may be more in the Northeast and the Southeast than it is in the Midwest or the West, because I've seen some data to suggest it. But the reflex has always been on the part of the medical staff or the nursing staff. If someone is sick, ship them out to the hospital. And a lot of it's done over the phone, you know, please, this patient has a fever of 102, the reflex by the doctor, send them to the ER. Well, the hospitals are not really equipped to deal with a lot of these people. And in our area, the hospitals are so filled that the patients end up sitting in the emergency room for 2 or 3 days on a hard gurney, and that also promotes bed sores and things like that, and they can't get out of bed. So Medicare took this very seriously. I mean, to Medicare's credit, about 20 years ago, and they created a couple of demonstration, or they asked for different demonstration products, and one of them that has taken root is called Evercare. Now, I also wear another hat in that I work for Evercare because our nursing home participates in the Evercare program. But basically what Evercare is a part of a large insurance company that says, you know what, we're going to specialize. We're only going to take care of people who live in nursing homes and are the frailest of the frail. And we're going to try to prove that by putting in certain measures into the nursing homes and recognizing conditions when they come about on the earlier side, that we're going to prevent people from going to the hospital. And it actually has worked tremendously well. They've lowered the hospitalization rate by about 50%. And in the meantime, saving Medicare a lot of money, which is part of why Medicare went into it. But I think there were some genuine quality issues that made them come up with it. So Evercare is available in many different states. And the way they do this is they place nurse practitioners into the nursing homes so that there is a full-time medical person there during the day. In most nursing homes, the doctor will come in sometimes 20, 30 minutes a day, sometimes an hour a week just on that day, and everything else is handled over the phone. So by putting more resources on the ground in the facility up front, we can recognize changes in condition, like an early infection, say someone is brewing a pneumonia. The first sign of that may be in the elderly that they're just not eating that well. They may not have the fever and the cough that younger people have. So using these very basic geriatric principles, which are time-honored, can really make a difference in care. And that, to me, is a very reassuring notion.
Mm. Something that was news to me in your book was the DNH.
Yes.
that order.
Three Ds, yeah.
An important one. Talk with us about what it is and how you approach sorting those issues out.
Right. The DNH, DNR was the original sort of acronym. That's do not resuscitate. So that's to avoid people who really don't stand much of a chance of getting a quality of life after cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR. So the DNR limits that. And in my facility, most of the residents who are of mind and most of their families will choose to make their loved one DNR, which is not to say we don't treat them aggressively if they're sick, if it's appropriate, but it means they don't put on they are not put on life support machine. The next wrinkle to that is what's called DNH, or do not hospitalize. So these are either residents themselves or more often than not family members who say, look, my loved one is now 99, has had Alzheimer's for 8 or 9 years. I don't want them going to the hospital. I want to, what you can do at the home is fine with me, whether that involves antibiotics or intravenous lines or whatever, or just comfort care, making the person comfortable. But I don't want the situation where suddenly I'm going to have my loved one in the emergency room with a doctor telling me, quote unquote, you have no choice. You've got to put them on life support. Because when it comes to that, it's hard to say no. And you have to be a pretty strong person and really know what you and your loved one would want. But most nursing homes will allow you to have a DNH order now. There's another movement called the POLST movement, POLST. In New York, it's known as the MOLST movement, but it's essentially the same thing. It means physician order for life-sustaining treatment. And it's a very nice, compact form that someone can fill out or a loved one can fill out under certain circumstances, which allows you to designate. It's almost like a menu saying, I want this, but I don't want this. And while it may seem formulaic and kind of cookbook, I think it goes a long way to allowing people to choose the kind of care that they want.
Mm. We haven't yet talked about medications yet. This is something that you deal with in the book, and it's pretty mind-boggling how many medications somebody could be on. How can we best advocate for what's right and sort out, what's needed and what's not needed? Who do we talk to?
I think it's one of those situations where it takes two to tango. I think it's easy to blame the medical industrial complex, as it were, and I do enough of that in my book, that I think I can be honest about it. It's one thing to blame them for overloading people with medications, but I think that a lot of the culture now is about drugs and medications, and for every one or two medications that a doctor insists someone should be on, I think the families, the residents themselves want them as well. So it really is going to be a test of our culture, whether we can begin to see clear of that sort of that notion. That said, there are certainly situations where people will end up on 10, 15, or 20 medications in a nursing home or as an outpatient. I mean, sometimes, the more specialists that are involved and the more times your family member goes to a different specialist, every time someone gives them one or two different medications. Along with that, Celeste, is the phenomenal sort of growth in what we know about diseases and how there are different types of medications to use. So I'll give you an example for Parkinson's disease, which is certainly more common as one ages. There was essentially one or maybe two medications that were used for years and years for that. Over the last 5 or 6 years, there have been several other medications or different groups of medications, and within each of those groups, there are two or three examples. Same goes for diabetes or depression, wherein people just kind of get layered with different medications. And with diabetes, where someone may have just been on one injection of insulin a day years ago, they now are on three or four injections of different specialty or boutique type of insulins in addition to two or three oral medications. So that's a tremendous multiplier. And I think it's very unfortunate. So part of our job as geriatricians and people who work in nursing homes is to say, to what end is that? Are we looking to extend life, as some of these studies may show, an extra 6 months or a year? Is that really the goal, or is it to make them comfortable and not be injected and subjected to these medications? I think there's nothing more depressing, and I see it day in, day out, that to sit down to breakfast and along with your French toast to see 15 pills that you have to take. I mean, I just see, the anxiety and the sadness that produces in people.
Yeah, that was really a tough issue for my mom. It seemed like she could handle so many, and then it was like, I don't need these.
Yeah, it's crushing. And then what we get, you know, it ends up that we defeat ourselves. Because then they don't, and I don't blame them, they don't want to take anything. And they just sort of want to resign themselves to whatever comes. Whereas a much more strategic look at it would be helpful. Now, again, to nursing home reform's credit, again, driven largely by Medicare, there is now a requirement that every facility have a pharmacy consultant. So that person's job is to look through the medication list once a month on every resident of the home and to make suggestions. Now, it depends on the consultant. Sometimes they're very aggressive, which is good, and sometimes they're a little bit less aggressive. It also, again, takes two to tango. They need a medical staff that's interacting and engaged with them and will listen to them. But the state surveyors are suddenly very tuned into this. I'd say in the last year or two, they are beginning to really harp on some of these issues. There's a federal requirement called F329, which is sort of where all this falls of unnecessary medications. And to my joy, I'm really seeing them begin to act on it.
Dr. Joshua Shore, our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Nursing Home Guide, A Doctor Reveals What You Need to Know About Long-Term Care. Questions, comments, they're invited. Listeners, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe we can backtrack a bit. And one of the points that you make in the book, at least a number of times, I would say, is that we really want to make the right choice at the outset because transitions are stressful and things can get lost or errors can happen along the way in moving people. Here's the question I have. Within a facility, there may be a number of options, independent living, assisted living, and skilled care. What questions are useful for making that decision and making a good decision at the get-go?
That's interesting. There are, it may be a phenomenon more of geography. In our area, there aren't as many facilities like that as I would like. They tend to be either one or the other. But there are some that have different levels, and some of them are called CCRCs, or Continuing Care Retirement Communities, which I think are terrific because it really does allow someone to be within the same facility, the same culture, the same family, and you know, have just a more natural aging process and these radical sort of changes in faces and ideology and things like that. So I think it's very important to visit them and to talk to the nurses or aides who are on those units and have the loved one there and have them really take a look. It's I think, tough when a social worker or intake person at a facility just hears things over the phone. I think it's really important for them either to get out and visit the person who may come in, a picture's really worth 1,000 words, or have that person come in themselves and take a look. But sometimes the a care manager, you know, one option is there are now these geriatric care managers, not case managers. Those are the people in the hospitals. But care managers are people out in the community who have some expertise in geriatrics or gerontology. And they can be found even in the Yellow Pages or on the Internet. There's a very nice website that will help you locate one in your area. But they can come and for an hour and a half, get to know the person and decide based on the facility that they may know very well where they would fit in. I think if you can afford it, it's usually not that expensive. It really might be worth it.
Mm-hmm. And here's another question I think you could give us some insight into. That is, when you have a lot of questions about Medicare, Medicaid, and other forms of insurance, who is likely to be able to help with those? Is there someone within a nursing home, or are there experts in this field, if there is such a thing out there, who can help us sort through finances?
Excellent question. The person at the in the nursing homes, there's usually a director of social worker intake who will take some kind of financial information. And it's probably best to be forthcoming because if it does end up in a Medicaid application of the state is very good right now at trying to sort these things out. So that person should be helpful. And usually they will hire someone if it's a big enough home to help the family access whatever funds they can, whether that's from a private, you know, long-term care insurance plan that they may have, which is becoming more popular, or to make the actual application to Medicaid. You know, these are, it's a lot of paperwork, and some people are just not up to it for various reasons. Short of that, though, if you're out in the community, an elder law attorney is probably a reasonable idea. You know, the dollars can add up quickly, but there are websites, again, to help you find them. I think it's NELA, National something of Elder National Elder Law Attorneys Society, and they're very good at sort of helping someone figure out how they're going to pay for all of this stuff or what they can do to protect a house. Or, you know, these rules are going to be changing right now as the Medicaid funding gets affected.
Hmm. What changes are on the horizon?
Well, in some states, I saw this terrible thing in New York where, again, I can't quote you the specifics because I'm just going to misrepresent it. But suddenly a group of people that was able to protect their house were no longer able to protect their house. So that's one sort of example. I think it was about 300 people in the whole state. But you know, I saw it maybe as a harbinger of what's to come. Also what they call the look-back period, which is the period, you know, with it, is where people can transfer money from an older member to a younger member and not have that count for the Medicaid determination. It used to be 2 years. Now I think it's 5 years in most states. And they're getting very strict about that, I think, probably with good reason.
Yeah, in Illinois, I do believe it is 5 years.
Yeah.
When should we begin to think about these issues, and any advice from where you sit about talking about these issues within the family, particularly sibling to sibling?
That's a great question. I you know, these are the very complex things because we live in a society where people not only grow distant sort of emotionally from each other and geographically, but on many different levels, and interpretations of what's happening to their parents is very different. And again, a lot of it's based on their own relationships that they have, their life, you know, their whole life with the family. We have wonderful examples where, you know, very cohesive families that really anticipate things well and think about it way ahead of time. And it's because the parent themselves brings it up and says, you know what, I want you to start looking into this. I feel like I'm going to be a burden, and I'm not comfortable driving anymore and this kind of thing. They're very self-aware. And there are others with the complete opposite, you know, experience where they will continue to drive when it's really not safe and really need to be in a different level of or different environment. And then there are issues where the siblings just don't agree at all or one doesn't want to be involved. I do encourage people when they visit the home to try to get as many of the siblings to go so they all hear the same thing and see the same thing.
Yeah. Well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us this
afternoon. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Joshua Shore has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Nursing Home Guide, A Doctor Reveals What You Need to Know About Long-Term Care. The book is available in paperback from Berkeley Books. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from Chicago and Kansas City. Here with those numbers, Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. Let's take a look at the numbers in Chicago at the CME Group on a Thursday afternoon. Futures from the soft red winter wheat pit finished the nearby March contract at $5.52 1/4 on the high side, the low at $5.36 there, and a settlement price at $5.38 3/4 a bushel. March soft red winter wheat down 4.5 cents on the day. The May futures 4.5 lower as well, $5.64 3/4 the top trade, the bottom at $5.48, settled at $5.51 1/2, down 4.5. July futures, the new crop harvest month, $5.77 1/4 the high, the low at $5.51, settled at $5.63 3/4, down 4.5 cents in September, a nickel lower at $5.88 3/4. March wheat in Kansas City test settled at $5.75. It finished down 3 cents. From the corn pit back in Chicago at the CME Group, nearby March contract at $3.77 3/4 top, bottom at $3.66, settlement price at $3.66 1/4, down 2 1/4. Just as a reminder, we always give you the composite trade for the settlements of the day. That means you get the overnight, the day trade, and the electronic trade all in one fell swoop, including what happened in the pit for the day. And we think that's the best way to chart the markets, says most of the trade now, about 85% of it, is in the E-trade. May futures in Chicago, $3.87 1/4, the high, the low at 75.5. Settlement price at $3.76, down 2.5 cents for the May corn futures. July at $3.97, top, bottom at $3.85 1/4. Settlement price at $3.85 1/2, down 2.5 in September. $4.05 3/4 the high, the low at $3.95 3/4. Settlement price $3.96, down 2 1/4 cents. December, which is the harvest month in the corn pit, a high price today at $4.19, the low at $4.07 1/2. The crop that's not in the ground yet, $4.07 3/4. The price down 2 1/4 cents for December corn at $4.07 3/4. March corn futures next year, 2010, that is, $4.31 3/4 the high, low at $4.20 1/2, settlement price at $4.21, down 2 3/4 on the afternoon. March oat futures up 2 cents today, $1.92 1/2 the high, the low at $1.86 1/4. Settlement price at 190.5, 2 cents higher. May futures up a penny and a half, $2. The high, the low at 194.25. Settlement price at 198.5, down or rather up 1.5 cents for the May out futures. Now the lower market. March futures in the bean pit, 985.25. The high, the low at 967.5. Settlement price $9.68.5, down 9.5 cents. May futures 988. The high, the low at 970.25. Settled at 971.5, down 10.5. And July futures 992. The high, the low at 973.75. Settled at 976, 11.75 lower. August soybean futures 978.25. The high, the low at 62.5. Settlement price at $9.64 a bushel, down 13.5 cents. And the November soybeans 918.75. The high, the low at $8.99. New crop beans settled 17 cents lower for the November, at $9.50. March bean meal futures down a buck, 310.30. The high, the low at 304.20. Settlement price at $304.70, a dollar lower for the March meal. May futures down $1.40 at 301.60. March bean oil 33.49. The high, the low at 32.75. Settlement price at 32.83, down 35. And the May bean oil 33.82. The high, the low at $33.07. Settlement price at 33.15. Down 36. During the closing mark report this afternoon, we'll talk, of course, with Dan Zwicker. He's at ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. And then later in the program, Gary Schnittke will be along with, a feature story that I produced this morning after we talked to him earlier in the week about the price of fertilizer in the Midwest and the pinch it might be putting dealers and companies in as we make our way toward the spring planting season. It all comes up during the closing mark report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. That's just a little less than 10 minutes away now. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Livestock contracts finished mixed on the day today. February live cattle, the high 84.50, the low 83.70, the settlement 84.35, that down 17.5. April, 87.70, the high 86.60, the low 87.50, the settlement, that down 10. June, 85.50, the high 84.40, the low 85.22.5, the settlement, that up a nickel. August, 86.17.5, the high, the low 85.25, the settlement 86.15, that up 17.5. March feeder cattle, 95.60, the high, 94.70, the low 95.15, the settlement, that down 25. April, 96.50, the high 95.85, the low 96.15, the settlement, that down 25. May, 97.92.5, the high, the low 97, even finishing at 97.80, down 10. August, $100.10, the high 98.95, the low $100 even, the settlement, that up 25. February lean hogs, 58.92.5, the high 58.25, the low, the settlement 58.82.5, that up 122.5. April 64.05, the high 62.20, the low 63.80, the settlement, that up 152.5. May 75.55, the high 74, even, the low 75.15, the settlement, that up 65. June lean hogs 76.95, the high 74.90, the low 76.80, the settlement, that up 150. And February pork bellies 80.90, the high 77.80, the low, and the settlement today, that down 20. The Dow is off 132 points at 78.07. The NASDAQ is off 30 points at 15.01. The S&P 500 down 23 at 8.11. Crude oil nearby month in New York down 196 at 33.85. 1 minute before 2 o'clock, this is WYLL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne is our technical director. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in the north, partly sunny, elsewhere mostly sunny. Highs ranging from 38 in northwestern Illinois to 57 in the far south. Tonight in southern and western Illinois, becoming partly cloudy, elsewhere mainly clear. Lows ranging from 20 in northwestern Illinois to 35 in the south. The outlook for tomorrow, Friday, in southern and western Illinois, partly to mostly cloudy. Showers of snow or mixed rain and snow possible in far western Illinois during the afternoon tomorrow. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny, with highs ranging from 34 in northwestern Illinois to around 55 in the south. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny, breezy, cooler, the high 47, the wind from the west at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Tonight, clear to partly cloudy, the low 27, the wind from the west to northwest at